Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk about Threepenny Opera, Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, Bullets Over Broadway, If Then, and The Mystery of Irma Vep. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 20th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Happy Easter.
Oh, happy Easter, you too. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Happy spring.
Thank you, you too. So, Peter and Michael got a chance to see the production of Threepenny Opera. Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Sure. Martha Clark, who's very famous for moving paintings, decided to take on this Brecht Weill Blitzstein musical. And it's at the Atlantic Theater Company until May 11th. It succeeds in showing us sexuality. It's less successful in showing us danger. She seems to really have centered on some nakedness, though not nearly as much as many people would want to see if they came to see nakedness. It's more of the now you see it, oh, you don't variety. So most of the sex acts are heterosexual, but not exclusively. Flimsy fabric seemed to cover braless bodies more often than not. There seemed to be a lot of that.
That sounds like a song lyric.
I suppose it does. if anybody who writes songs is listening, by all means, take the image and run with it. So what was missing was sordidness that I usually see in Threepenny Operas. Usually there's enough to make even Brecht want to take a shower, which, believe me, didn't happen that often, but that's another story. So I don't know. McKeith wasn't dangerous enough either. First off, he was in a Savile Row suit that looked like it cost quite a bit of money. All right, that's fine for the boss. But all his followers looked equally as dapper, which really surprised me. Now, I know people dressed better in those days, but these guys really didn't. So so I thought that was not so good. Terry Teachout said it very well when he called McKeith Mac the butter knife. It's funny, I thought of him as Mac the plastic knife, you know, so that's what I also found some sort of strangeness in the fact that she drained the flavor by dropping the names of the toadies. Filch was there, but I mean, such colorful names as Ready Money Matt, Crookfinger Jack, Sawtooth Bob, all gone, all ensemble, and that was that. And I found that as a metaphor of lack of specificity in these characters. So in terms of the music, like plenty of other directors, she took Barbara's song from Lucy and gave it to Polly, but she moved to the stable scene after the marriage, which is, and having Polly explain her feelings for McKeith to his henchmen isn't as powerful as when she told them to her parents. So that was strange. Laura Osnes sang beautifully here. And Michael Park, who plays McKeith, sang very well too. Sally Murphy, Jenny, and sang Pirate Jenny. Nice staging here when she literally backed herself into a corner in Solomon's Song. Though that was slightly rearranged too, which was strange. The lyrics were. And Lucy Brown, Clark borrowed a song from a different source entirely. The Ballad of the Drowned Girl comes from Das Berliner Requiem. And Lily Cooper delivered it very well. It's to Lucy, I think, and the plot, but it did allow Lucy some sensitivity and let us meet her before the latest scene with McKeith and Polly. So I like that. And while many Lucys have implied they're pregnant, Clark had her well into the second trimester, so that was that was pretty different too.
At first I was like, gee, gosh, Lily, I haven't seen you in a while.
Yeah, good point. That's true. You know,
I mean, sometimes we don't know, you know.
Yeah, it's a very good point. So F. Murray Abraham's in it, and he doesn't have a very good voice, and he doesn't have to, because Brecht and Weill were very famous for saying, we want actors who can sing rather than singers who can act. So Mary Beth Peel, same thing, playing his wife. The song's a little too high for her, I thought. So that was this production has received a lot of negativity among the people I know. And I didn't think it was a disaster. I didn't think it was a disgrace. I just thought it could have been better. And if the attention given to the sexuality, which was really intense attention, if that had been given to the rest of the show, I think it really could have been memorable.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Yeah, I basically agree, and I think that's what I'm hearing from everyone, Peter.
Oh, yeah?
It seems like what, you know, how sometimes, you know, you can't find two people that have the same opinion on a show.
Sure.
And then other times it really seems like there's a consensus. It seems like people are saying there's not enough danger. And that's the primary complaint I'm hearing. This is, I've always thought of this as one of the, if not the toughest show, musical to direct. And if someone ever offered it to me, I'd have to think a really long time before accepting the assignment, because it just, it seems like it's so tricky. And, you know, depending so much on, you know, like having every person perfectly cast, not just, you know, four out of five people, but five out of five people, and really working on the tone and the extent to which you're going to be playing to the audience, and rather, you know, as opposed to the other characters, and how exactly the Brechtian alienation effect is going to be achieved or abandoned. So it's so many things to decide. In Michael Park's case, for example, I mean, I don't believe that we ever. All right, so we have the tremendously famous opening ballad of Mack the Knife, in which we hear about all of these women that he's killed, and maybe a couple of men too. So that establishes it. I'm not aware of any actual call to see him actually kill anyone during the show, right?
Well, you know what I found interesting was that he had salt and pepper hair, and I started thinking, well, maybe what she was doing, I should have mentioned this earlier, was that he's aging. He's out of gas. In fact, that might even explain why he decided to get married too. You know, he's going to settle down. So I think there's something to be said for that. And I should concede that point, that maybe his real, not that he quite wants to go straight, but that at least he's a little tired of leading the life that we heard. John Kelly, by the way, the famous downtown artist, sings Mack the Knife here, and does it with quite a bit of brio. So that occurred to me when I saw the salt and pepper here when he took off his hat.
Oh, right. Well, that is a very, very interesting point, although not exactly what I meant. What I was just saying.
No. It just occurred to me. I'm sorry. I was adding. Yeah.
No, but what I was saying is that you can't. I mean, you certainly don't expect the guy to seem dangerous all the time, because then why would anyone? He's supposed to be kind of more like a Iago or a charming.
Charming.
You know, like a someone who all the women fall in love with, obviously, and he. I mean, he's supposed to, his menace and his danger are, I think, only supposed to be evident in flashes. So it's not like it's supposed to play it all through, you know. So maybe it's just a question of like a couple of moments where he could have, you know, just kind of given a really cold stare to somebody, and that might have been enough to up the danger quotient for that character sufficiently. Because I thought, you know, he fit the part very well in other ways. I mean, maybe did look a little too clean cut and spiffy as you know, but there again, there's the the fine line, because he is their leader and he's the one, you know, he's supposed to go out in society and he's, you know, whereas the other guys, yes, the other guys should not look, you know, they should look a little more, a little more raffish, if that's the word. So I, you know, I actually was disappointed with John Kelly's rendition of Mac the Knife, because I certainly don't think anyone feels that a pretty voice is required, but I don't know. It just didn't seem pointed enough to me. His voice didn't seem quite strong enough. He kept sliding off that repeated note every time, you know, da 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 da, da 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 da, you know, every single time. And I think maybe that's because he's not primarily a singer. So that to me, sort of marred the show a little bit from the beginning. And I think if you had nothing else changing it, but you had a stronger singer there, that might have made a big difference in the perception of the tone of the whole piece. But I certainly agree about Laura Osnes and who else should we single out here? Yeah, Lily Cooper. You know, I mean, the last time I saw her was, you know, playing a teenager in Spring Awakening, and it's nice to see her again. And she really has an excellent voice, which she didn't get to use that much in Spring Awakening. So that was very nice to see. It's also, I'm glad to see Sally Murphy looking and sounding so fantastic. Mm-hmm. As Jenny, I mean, if I didn't know how long she's been around and you asked me how old this woman was, I would say, I don't know, like maybe very early 30s. But she really looked great. The makeup for her character was fantastic, I thought. And I enjoyed the dog. the dog Romeo, one of four dogs in four shows I've seen this week. Mm-hmm. There is a dog in Lady Day. Mm-hmm. There's a dog in Of Mice and Men, though I haven't seen that one yet. And there's a dog in Bullets Over Broadway. So I don't know what this is in the zeitgeist, but maybe you guys can figure it out.
It means Bill Berlone is very busy. That's what he's Bill Berlone, for those who don't know who I mean, is an animal trainer who got his start through Annie.
Yep.
He was working on it at Good Speed, and they needed a dog for Annie back in 1976. And he went out and he found this pooch who was marked for extinction and really made it a star. And this became his business. He's in the last almost 40 years, he's provided virtually all the trained animals for Broadway shows. So God love him for doing it.
Final thing on Three Penny, the orchestra is at the back of the stage and mostly enclosed. And some people objected to that. They felt it muffled the sound or whatever. I did not think that. I thought that it wound up providing an absolutely perfect balance between the singers, who were also mic'd, I'm sure, and the orchestra. And the other ironic thing is that someone commented when Three Penny Opera first opened in 1954, it was supposed to be intended to be a much leaner and meaner sound from the orchestra than you would ever hear on Broadway, you know, as part of the whole Brecht Weill aesthetic. But now it's like you go down to the Atlantic Theater and, oh, this is the lushest orchestra I've heard lately.
Actually, the putting it in the back was something that Brecht and Weill intended from way back in. That was something they wanted. So that's what I thought you were going for, that they were so that's being.
I didn't know that, but I think people were also.
Yes, I know your point. You know, there are probably more musicians than there are at Mamma Mia. Yeah. Yeah.
No, but I think also some people were objecting to the fact that the orchestra was mostly enclosed.
Mm-hmm.
Rather
mm-hmm.
than just being completely visible.
Uh-huh.
But that might have been, you know, just a little overwhelming in terms of the brass. So I think they made the right decision.
That is the way it was originally intended, though, I believe, to have them back there in a little room.
Great.
I think that sounds familiar to me. So
okay, so then they did exactly what they were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So a question that will help us transition to the next segment is, did the dog get a bio?
I think he did, actually. I guess Bill got the bio. The dog shows up at the end pretending to be Queen Victoria.
That was not like
And I guess that's a comment on the Queen Victoria wasn't so attractive a lady, that she did she did not have a face and body that would launch 1,000 ships. Yeah,
see,
I guess that's...
Here, Romeo was adopted by trainer guardian William Berlone in 2012 from the Associated Humane Society in Newark, New Jersey.
Ah, look at that.
He was part of a cruelty case where he was rescued from life as a junkyard dog.
Wow.
He made his theatrical debut February of 2013 as Rufus in Legally Blonde and loves being an actor. He wishes to thank Martha Clark for giving him his first serious role.
Gee, I cannot see that dog as Bruiser. I mean, I think he's cast. Seriously, I think
Bruiser's usually a, isn't it usually a tactical thing?
Yeah, I mean, really, this dog, you know, weighed a ton, and I mean, I don't know how she picked him up, you know what I mean? So, but anyway, all right.
Smaller then.
Moving on. You got a transition, you said, right?
Yes.
We ruined it?
No, you didn't, actually. My wife and I saw Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill yesterday, and my wife was saying, who's the third actor?
Uh-huh.
Because there's three bios, Audra, Sheldon, and Roxy.
Right.
Because, you know, we were, you know, 2/3 of the way through the show and hadn't seen the third actor yet that, and she said, and she thought, you know, it was the trio, the piano, bass, and drums that she was like, who didn't get a bio, the bass guy or the drum guy, you know? And I was like, neither of them did because it was Roxy. So anyway, the three of us got a chance to see Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, yeah, I think I've mentioned this before, but just in case I haven't, or just in case, it's been a case that I people weren't listening on the day that I mentioned it. Years ago, I was talking to Audra McDonald, and it was when she was up for her fifth Tony for Marie Christine. And I said, do you think you're going to win? And she said, I don't think anybody thinks I need another Tony. And of course, since then, she won another one for Raisin in the Sun. Frankly, I think they should make it a six pack. I truly do. Because I think this is her best performance ever. Certainly, it's her most demanding performance ever because she never leaves. Well, she does leave the stage, actually, but she virtually doesn't leave the stage. But she has to do all these songs. She has to imitate Billie Holiday. Now, here's what's really significant to me, that when this project was announced, I can't tell you how many people said, well, are they crazy? She doesn't look anything like this. She doesn't sound like Billie Holiday. This is ridiculous.
That was me. That
oh,
was
you too?
Me.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. I can't say I'm an expert on Billie Holiday, but I certainly have heard enough recordings to think that she's doing a spectacular job of sounding like Billie Holiday and even looking like her. There's a very famous picture of Billie Holiday opening her mouth wide and at an angle, and I'm telling you, she even replicates that perfectly. So I'm not that interested in the show itself. I don't think it's that riveting, because what we're doing is we're seeing Billie Holiday towards the end of her life. I think it's about 5 months before she actually dies, and she is certainly that's what comes from too much pills and liquor, I guess, and more than that, that's what's going on. So she's not competent up there, and certainly her piano player is trying to get her on track, and that's where most of the drama is. But it wears thin after a while, and if they didn't have Audra, I'm telling you, the show wouldn't be nearly as riveting. It's a very profane show, I'll tell you that. She uses every four-letter word except tact. So that's be apprised. People who are going to be offended by that are certainly going to be offended, because I don't think there's one she misses. So be aware of that. But you know, a little credit to while we're talking about Sheldon Becton, who plays the pianist, who does that thing where he plays slowly and deliberately at the beginning of songs, as if to say, this is what you should be singing now, and you shouldn't be talking. But, you know, Billie had a lot to say, you know, and she certainly did say it. I mean, she talks about her drug and alcohol abuse, her address, arrests, her prison time, being raped, that she's had time as a prostitute. But you don't necessarily get to hear songs the way you think you will, because occasionally she feels free to interrupt them, to whatever comes through her head. That's what's going on there. And by the time she sings a song called Crazy He Calls Me, the audience is ready to agree. So, but wow, my God, is there anything this woman cannot do? And I imagine there are going to be, if she does win again, there are going to be four other actresses who are going to be livid, and plenty of other people too, saying, doesn't she have enough Tonys? And actually, yeah, but what do you do when she's giving her best performance of any of the times we've seen her on stage? What do you do? I mean, isn't it on merit? So anyway,
Peter, the I find that the Boston fans are mostly angry with the Yankees because the Yankees have won 27 World Series, and haven't they won enough? But as you said, if they earned it, that's what it is.
They didn't earn it last night, James.
So. Oh, no, they didn't.
Apparently not.
That's a whole other podcast, yeah.
It sure is.
Michael, what were you saying?
I said, no, apparently not. They did not earn it last night.
So, Michael, you saw it as well. What did you think?
Well, the vocal impression, imitation, channeling, whatever word you want to use, absolutely astonishing. Mm-hmm. My friend gasped when she started to sing. My friend who's worked with her, he, you know, and what did we expect exactly? I mean, I said... when this was announced, I said, what is this all about? I look and sound more like Billie Holiday than Audra McDonald. I just didn't know. I mean, obviously, I had no idea if she could or would do a dead on, absolutely accurate vocal imitation. But also, I wasn't sure, yeah, if that would be the route she would choose, because on the one hand, I couldn't imagine her doing anything else. But then, obviously, the audience doesn't get to hear her regular, famous, gorgeous, beautiful voice. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering. I mean, I wasn't 100% sure. And then I had been told that, for example, when Lynette McKee did this show originally, that she did not attempt to imitate Billie Holiday in this way. So I really was not sure what to expect. And then the first few seconds of it, you know, it was clear that, oh, my God, it's just incredible. I don't know how much. I'd love to know. Has she written about it? Has she been interviewed? Did she grow up listening to Billie Holiday? It sounds like that sound is like just in the core of her brain, and she can just reproduce it like to an almost freakish extent. That you, if they make a cast album of this,
they are, and
you know, and you put it on. I mean, aside from the sound quality, I guess, mm-hmm. you would never know that it's mm-hmm. not her. I ran home last night and I put on two or three Billie Holiday albums, and I was like, holy God, it's incredible. And I had been told by someone that it was incredible, but that's not the same as hearing it.
Hearing it, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So for what it's worth also, she in the show, I would say for the first third of it, maybe she's pretty much in command and singing the songs like really kind of strongly and not meandering, and she's already a little in her cups, but not a lot. And then she does deteriorate as the show goes on, and she starts to drink more and more. So that's what you can expect from that. But you do get to hear a lot of songs, delivered, you know, pretty much straightforward and without tremendous effects of alcohol or drugs on them. And it's some great songs too. Crazy He Calls Me, the obvious God Bless the Child, and Strange Fruit, which, you know, in the context of the show here is just, it's so sad. It's hard to even discuss it. What else? I love the setup of the band on stage and the group in the center of the theater that just represents the actual patrons at the club and they're seated at tables, and there's even an onstage bar that they I guess they can order from before the show, not during it. Here's an interesting thing: during the performance, I saw two or three people got up during the show, and at least one of them was in that center section, and I think he got up and walked into the vomitorium.
Mm-hmm.
I guess by mistake, you know, because he was looking for the men's room, or I don't know what, you know. But I thought that was going to turn out to be another character, like her manager. But not at all. But anyway, yeah, Audra McDonald. Yeah, if she gets another Tony, I would not say that there would be a very much argument against that at all. I, as I pointed out, did not think she deserved the last one for Porgy and Bess, just because I greatly dislike the conception of the whole production and her character. But this is absolutely stunning. And how isn't it funny how things happen in the theater? I get the impression that this was thrown together at virtually the last minute, when it turned out that Bronx Bombers, that had been in that space, had a very, very short run. I'm sure much shorter than anyone ever dreamed. And
well,
so,
Lonnie Price said to me, okay, he said, seriously, if that show had run another week, we wouldn't have been able to do it. We needed exactly as much time as we had to put it together. Yeah, this one did come out of nowhere. They did, last August, they did a workshop, and in January, they did another workshop. So as he said, we were quiet about it. We didn't know if anything was going to come of it. We had no idea what could possibly come of it. But he said, another week and they wouldn't have been able to do it. So thank you, Bronx Bombers, for leaving early.
Wow, that's amazing.
Just like last night, the Bronx Bombers left early, didn't they, James?
They did.
But that's another story.
Some might say that they didn't even show up. So we got a chance to see Lady Day as well. And you guys have covered 99.9% of what I thought about it. Amazing. And she, I feel very bad for Tony voters because they have an extraordinary embarrassment of the riches to choose from in this year's crop of leading women in a musical. So we'll see what happens there. And I couldn't be sad if she won it, because she was Audra was amazing. Michael touched upon something that I wanted to talk about just for a moment or so. There is another podcast out that I listen to called the Theater People Podcast, and they interviewed Anika Larsson last week, and I encourage everybody to take a listen to it. It's a wonderful hour of in-depth interview with her, and she talked about how when Jesse Mueller sings as Carole King, that, you know, it's such a different thing for Jesse, in that, you know, backstage Jesse fools around or whatever, and she can hear. And those of us who've seen Jesse in other shows can hear what a glorious voice Jesse has outside of that range of the Carole King, which is the same sort of thing as the Audra McDonald thing with Lady Day. And so I thought that that was an interesting aspect of it, that you have so many actors out there that are playing these roles, and you don't really hear the full range of their voice, which is a lot of fun. The other aspect of it was that we saw it yesterday at the matinee, so that's Saturday, the 19th matinee, and our audience was just horrendous.
I don't go to
matinees very often, and so I don't know if it was a matinee audience or just something else that I just hit the lottery. But on the left of us was somebody. I guess they're selling mixed drinks before the show. Brought a couple of mixed drinks back to the seat, and this woman was easily 300 pounds and drinking and eating and drinking and eating. And when she finished up her thing, she unscrewed the top of the drink to tip her head all the way back and hold it up for 30 seconds. She kept on looking at her playbill to see when the show was over. What it was just horrendous, and that was to my left. And on my right, there was a gentleman who thought that this was, he was part of the show and this was a cabaret act, and he kept on talking back to Audra.
Oh.
And
oh boy, how did she deal with it?
ignored it totally. You know, we were not in that cabaret section in the very center where she was interacting with folks. We were on the side in row D, so four rows back. But just horrendous audience behavior, and I you know, I rarely go to matinees, and I don't know if I can attribute this to matinees or if it just happened to be that these people were there. So
well, now you can go on Thursdays, James.
Yes, Thursdays.
At least the three shows, right?
Yeah, the Thursday matinees. That's a fun topic we should talk about.
It's
after.
Too bad, but yeah, I'm telling you, I wasn't, you know, obviously didn't want to pay too much attention to the three or four people who left and then returned to their seats during Lady Day. But I'm like, it's only an hour and a half, folks.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and as I say, at least one of them was right smack dab in that center, you know, that center bar section. I don't get it.
If that's what I have to suffer through to see Audra.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's what I do. We call that first world problems on Facebook, you know. Everybody's throwing their headphones at us right now because the three of us had a chance to see this awesome performance.
Sure, sure.
And many won't. And I hope that...
Well, yeah, no, yeah, but we're not the only ones that are disturbed.
No, but on the other hand, critics get a lot of heat for being this, that, and the other thing. But nevertheless, we're pretty good audiences. You know, we don't do any of these things. And
poor Brent Brantley getting criticized with James Franco.
You know, the other night when I went to A Mice and Men, it was the day that story broke, and Mr. Franco came on stage and did not get entrance applause, and I wonder if that had anything to do with it. I expected the audience to go, you know, crazy, he is a movie star, but nothing. And I wonder if that had something to do with it. I expected the applause to start. I mean, I guess I could have started it myself, but nevertheless, I was surprised.
Well, we came out Lady Day last night, and the next show, we had a matinee in an evening. We went to see Violet last night after Lady Day. And so we were walking through the theater district, and the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people around Mice and Men waiting for Mr. Franco to come out. And then when he came out, it was like the Beatles.
Well, there you are. So maybe it was the Brantley influence. And in fact, very quickly about Violet, which we'll talk about at another time after Michael's seen it. But nevertheless, did you notice, James, that the lights come up on Sutton Foster and they wait for the applause?
Because
it wasn't until the applause happened that then the musical director started. Why didn't the musical director start the music as soon as we saw her face? They wanted that applause for her. Fine. Yeah, two Tonys, you know, a lot of performances that people have loved. Sure, fine, let her have it. But my point is, there's no question they're making a concerted effort that she get it. So,
well, I was going to say, my memory of Mice and Men, isn't it, first of all, isn't it rather a soft entrance? And don't George and Lenny walk onto the stage at the same time?
Yes, they do, but that doesn't preclude the fact that people wouldn't applaud. I've seen two people come on. Enzio Pinzer and Mary Martin came on together, and I bet they both.
What I meant was that you and I may not be that familiar with him, but Chris O'Dowd is also really quite.
Yeah. You know, I mean, so, that too.
But maybe it's just because they just kind of like wander on through the woods.
They do, but still, I've seen less clean entrances that have gotten applause. Right. You know, I mean, if you want to applaud for your star, you applaud for the star. You know, and I was just surprised that nobody did. I wonder if it's resumed. I mean, if it was just that one night only. I have no idea.
All right. So let's move
next
forward on to Bullets Over Broadway. The three of us got a chance to see this. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Bullets?
Well, I guess I felt it started off really well, and I was thinking I was going to really love it. Especially, I should mention right at the outset, a friend of mine said, the way he phrased it, it has the best sounding pit on Broadway. And I can't argue with that. Just a combination of the players in the orchestra and the fact that they're not over amplified, and the arrangements and the orchestrations, it's at absolute perfection, I would say. It's a great old theater that is acoustically viable. So maybe that allowed them to not have to amplify everything up the wazoo. So that is a very positive aspect. The sets and costumes are quite wonderful and amazing. And also I mean, I do not object per se to using old songs, as the score of your musical and writing a book around them, or adapting a book around them. I guess especially when the songs are not necessarily ones that have been recycled so many times before. You know, I mean, a lot of these songs are of a somewhat older period. Location of the time, it says, well, location, New York City, 1929. So that's specifically when we're supposed to be happening. And so you get Tiger Rag, G-Baby, Ain't I Good to You, the Hot Dog Song, you know, some real obscurities, and then, you know, more famous things like up a Lazy River, and et cetera, et cetera. Let's Misbehave was in there, which I was interested to see, because that's a Cole Porter song, which was interpreted in the version of Anything Goes, which was licensed at the time when I was doing high school shows. So I know we did that song as sung by Reno and Cerevelin. That's here. And that's one of the more famous songs, I would say. And then, all of these songs are used. But I have to say, there was much made in the New York Post by Michael Riedel about how he and everyone else in the world, except Woody Allen, thought that it was silly to use Yes, We Have No Bananas as the finale of the show. And I should say, I'm a little late now, that song is not listed in the song list. Did you notice that?
No, I didn't.
It is not listed. So I guess I don't know if that means they were going to take it out and then he insisted they keep it in. I don't know if it means that they think it's sort of a comic spoiler, mm-hmm. so they didn't list it, in which case I just ruined it. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say I ruined it, because I think the song shouldn't be there. That didn't fit at all. But also, I mean, there's a lot of songs that don't fit. There's some that do. There's a lot that really don't. Well, you know, what does Runnin' Wild have to do with the, you know, why would they sing Runnin' Wild while they're all, you know, on the train headed up to Boston for the out of town tryout? It just didn't seem like the lyrics had anything to do with what they were about to do. And for that matter, they have the Maren Mazey character's first song is They Go Wild, Simply Wild Over Me, which is an old song that was not written for Irene, I believe, but interpolated into the 70s revisal of Irene. And that is a song that, again, that I sang in my high school production. So I was happy to hear the song again, but I don't think that, I don't know, it doesn't really seem to fit that character. It's a kind of a lighthearted song, you know. I mean, Helen is more, I think she's a little more self-conscious and pretentious to sing something so delightfully up and cute and fizzy. So I had mixed feelings about hearing that song, and I just felt that, you know, every other song didn't really belong. I guess that was kind of what I felt. But my last point that I want to make is, boy, you know, when we get to a Woody Allen musical where he cannot write a decent one-liner, I don't know what that says for the theater. There's this horrendous joke about that the lead character makes about how some alternative new version of Pocahontas where Priscilla Alden rejects Miles Standish, and so Miles rapes a turkey. That joke did not go over well.
It's surprising too, because I mean, you know, rape is now such a red flag word.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I'm amazed that you would even go for that.
Would screws a turkey have been less funny? I mean, I would have laughed at that, I think. And, you know, I think the lot of reason the people didn't laugh is they heard rape and they immediately clammed up.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the completely unnecessary remark that I'm sure much of the audience didn't get about how Irving Berlin has a little black boy in a closet who really writes all of his songs.
By the way, for the record, that was a widely held theory. I'm not saying it should be in the show. I just want to point out that that wasn't a Woody Allen concoction as much as a story that had been circulated. I remember hearing that as a child. As a child, I remember hearing that by people who knew nothing about show business. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it belongs in the show. I'm not saying how funny, nothing like that. I'm just saying that that is not Woody Allen's imagination, as we assume the turkey raping is Woody Allen's imagination.
No,
I don't recall reading that in my history book in school,
Right, but his decision to let's put in that joke about Irving Berlin and the little black boy. All right.
Oh, yeah, that's
why, this is another case where I saw the film and I really don't, I think I enjoyed it at the time, but now I see things that must have been in the film that really bothered me. I mean, in this musical, three characters are shot dead on stage. And I know, I guess it's supposed to be quote unquote cartoon violence. They're still shot dead on stage, and in the context of this incredibly lighthearted musical comedy. Somebody's shot in Book of Mormon. I think I saw another show recently where someone is shot dead. I just think it's all part of this desperation. Do more. Do something outrageous. Like, do anything to get the audience to pay attention. And if they're sleeping, they'll hear the gunshots and they'll wake up and they'll have a reaction.
Michael, did you see Michael Riedel's column on? They're taking out the word "fuck" from the matinee performances so that they could sell it to school groups. And Michael Dale posted on Broadway Star. So Michael Dale posted on Facebook. He said, good thing they took out the word "fuck," but the murders, they're okay.
I know. And I said, exactly, Michael, thank you. And may I say that every time the word "fuck" is used in this, it seems to me like just desperation. And it also takes me out of the period. I'm sure people said "fuck" in 1929, but I don't think I think it was probably like really reserved for like incredibly intense occasions. It wasn't just a word thrown around like this. So I'm amazed at Woody Allen. I really am. I guess he's had other things on his mind.
Peter, what did you think about this?
Well, Bullets Over Broadway is one of my favorite movies. I literally watched it for the 23rd time, to quote the baker's wife. I mean that before seeing the musical. Just to bone up, even though I knew it chapter and verse. And so I was very disappointed in this show. I certainly was disappointed when I heard they weren't going to use an original score. I remember when Marvin Hamlisch was going to be working on this. And I'm guessing that this was a case of two titanic egos that couldn't get along. And I think that must be why Marvin Hamlisch said, "I ain't doing this," because, Woody Allen, I'm guessing, said, "Hey, this is my baby and we're doing it my way." So whenever that happens, you're better off with dead composers and lyricists. So the thing is, when you shoehorn existing songs into a show, so many times you're saddled with lyrics that don't have anything to do with anything. And so many of these songs that they use, the title applies and then the other lyrics don't. Now, to be fair, Glenn Kelly has come in and written some new lyrics, and I wish he had done a complete overhaul on all the lyrics and make them specific to the characters, because the ones he's done are quite good. So, yes. But what are you going to do when you have, it's one thing for the hitman Cheech to be telling David Chayne, the playwright, "'Tain't nobody's business if I do." Sure, fine, yes. But the images that come afterwards are much too soft. Mm-hmm. If I don't go to church on Sunday, that's not what this guy would say. So that's a real problem. And also the songs you miss. There's Helen Sinclair, the pretentious actress, coming on stage the first day of rehearsal and saying, "Ah, this theater, this church, there's Ophelia, there's Cordelia." Well, there's your song, but we don't hear it because nobody wrote that in the 20s. Similarly speaking, this, by the way, we haven't even made this clear for those who don't know the movie. This is about a playwright who has had two failures, and this time it isn't going to happen again. So as a result, he is going to be directing the play. Where he does compromise, however, is that the gangster is putting up the money so that his girlfriend can be in the play, and the girlfriend is truly terrible. So so now, while he's working on the play, the girlfriend's bodyguard, that's Cheech, is in rehearsals, and he starts making suggestions, and everybody thinks they're very good suggestions, and eventually he turns out rewriting the play and turning it into something truly trenchant and wonderful. And the point, but the thing is, he can't stand Olive. And in the musical, they make the mistake of making them enemies at the beginning of the show. And the point is, he does not like her and she does not like him. So as a result, at the end of the show, when he kills her so that she won't have to be in the play and he won't have his play destroyed, it isn't as powerful as it is in the movie when he kills her simply for that reason. He doesn't want her in the play because if he saw the understudy do it at one performance and she was terrific, and that's who he wants in the show. That's a very different thing. It really shows the point of the whole movie is a true artist will not compromise. He will kill to make his work be successful and worthy. While the non-artist, and David Chang comes to that point in the movie where he says, I'm not an artist. He tells his girlfriend that. That's a lesson to be learned, too. Some people who are willing to compromise, therefore, are not true artists. Well, fine, but Woody Allen's compromised a lot here, you know, and it's very sad to see what's happened here. Now, it starts off with a small floor show that's done in a nightclub, and I was thinking, well, you know, what can you do with that? I've seen those floor shows in nightclubs, and the choreography is never terribly interesting. So in essence, Susan Stroman here is telling us the truth by giving us a small, uninteresting floor show, but still, we want to be entertained, you know, so I think that's a bit of a problem. There were so many little details, you know, that struck me as bizarre. Yes. There's a line about she'll win an award for her performance. They weren't giving out awards at that time for theater. The Oscars had started 2 years, it was set in 1929, by the way. The Oscars had started by then, but there were no theater awards. So what awards are we talking about? You know, I agree entirely, Michael. They go wild. Simply Wild Over Me is not with Helen Sinclair would say. She would not. This, in the movie, in the Oscar-winning performance by Diane Weiss, she held her cards very close to her vest.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't do it here. She's far too overt. Even when in the movie, when she says to him, you see right through me, don't you? She doesn't think for a second he sees right through her. She's playing a game. Here, Marion Mazzie was vulnerable. Now, here's what's interesting to me. You know, back in September, when this project was really going to be real and everybody knew it was really coming, how much scuttlebutt there was on who was going to play Helen Sinclair. So many names were mentioned. This was the plum role of the season. Well, it doesn't seem like the plum role of the season, and I am not blaming Marin Mazzie. I am not. The point is that the part seems so diluted here. It doesn't have the impact it does in the film. So that's a real big problem. So to think that this role that everybody thought was going to be so magnificent barely makes an impression. I'm not saying that Marin Mazzie won't get a nomination. I'm not quite saying that, and she may get one because she hasn't won in her previous four attempts, and maybe there will be some sort of sympathy vote for her. But if we're going to go by real worth here, again, I'm not blaming her. The role just isn't good enough here. There's another big mistake made. In the movie, Harvey Fierstein plays her agent. And at the beginning of the movie, the first time we ever see her, she's arguing with him because she doesn't want to take the part in this play. And he tells her that she's had flops in a row, and you are now better known as a drunk and an adulteress. Okay. It's one thing for your agent, who is long-suffering, who has put up with your garbage, to say that. Yes, an agent would say that to somebody under these circumstances. All right. Here, they don't have an agent. It's the producer who goes to get her to sign on the dotted line. A producer would never say to a star he's courting, you're a drunk and an adulteress. You'd never do that, you know? So, and, you know, it's not, there are so many guys playing these murderous goons. Take one of them. Make them the agent. Why yes. not? You know, I mean, it's not, you know, if you don't have the cast, fine. But, I mean, there are plenty of people hanging around who in trench coats and, you know, low-slung hats, you know, so nobody's going to notice that that's so do that. I think that's Yeah, again, the idea of having original songs, we would have seen Cheech get excited and make suggestions of what the play should be, you know, and everyone could modulate higher, you know, and when he comes up. Now, here's a problem with the play within a play, because the play within a play is supposed to be this trenchant, important, searing drama. And yet, we hear lines that are added, and lines are added for comic effect. We're supposed to get laughs out of them. There's a double entendre involving a pool cue and chalk it up and all that kind of, but it's not for a serious drama. And we are led to believe that's more than led to believe. I mean, the reviews that it gets at the end, you know, are lines like a brilliant night in the theater, that type of thing, a memorable theatrical masterpiece, a play of substance and death. Those are quotes that actually happen, you know, and it's not. So I think that's a big problem as well. And the obvious humor, like, for example, an aftershave is mentioned as Moonlight and Bensonhurst. Okay, now who, you know, the best comedy is true comedy. You know, there would never be a cologne by that name. I mean, so, but that's, we're looking for cheap jokes there, you know, so, so that's, yeah, by the way, even in 1959, let alone 1929, there would not be the word bullshit in a play, and we're led to believe that that's the case here. So, so that's a problem as well. So, again, to get in that hot dog number that Michael alluded to. So this is the scene in which playwright and producer come to the gangster's apartment, and they're meeting Olive, his girlfriend, for the first time. And in the movie, she really wants to make a great impression that she's this grande dame. You know, she keeps saying charmed, and she puts out her hand to have it kissed. A good joke, by the way, about that hand kiss in the musical. It's not in the movie, I don't think. But anyway, in the movie, she's trying to put on the dog, and she's trying to indicate that she's really this terrific actress. So in the musical, she's stupider, because she does this number about hot dogs that's all double entendres, about put the hot dog in my roll, that type of thing. And, you know, it's not as funny, because it's so obvious. She seems stupider here. Jennifer Tilly really seemed convincing. This woman does not. It's one note. It's one dimensional. It's what she's been given. You know, again, I don't blame her. You know, so, so yeah, this was an intense disappointment for me, more so than I expected. Because I did expect to be disappointed simply from the recycled songs, but right. to see little mistakes here and there, you know, made, you know, those little mistakes add up, and they turn out to really, ruin, the evening. That said, I'm not blaming the cast, and, not that she has so great a part. But pay attention to Betsy Wolfe, who plays David Shane's girlfriend. She has a very nice duet with him in the first act. And in the second, she has a So Long Dearie type number. I won't say it's as good as that, believe me. But nevertheless, it's that type of number. And watch this lady. This is the real thing. This is a real musical comedy person. Somebody also, who really has it in her.
At the performance I attended, the single person who I would say really walked away with the show was Brooks Osmanskas. He was so brilliant. I mean, he did everything right. The audience loved him, and I felt that in the beginning, and I felt it at the end, and I think he got, you know, I think he got the most applause. And he deserved it. My friend and I were commenting on how perfect he was, and it seemed like he really worked at it and really got it.
Well, for those who don't know the picture, he plays Warner Purcell, who is an actor who has an eating disorder, and he promises he's going to go on a diet, and he promises he's going to lose the weight, and he's going to stay trim, and at the first rehearsal, he's having hot water, you know, while all those pastries are there. Here, they make him dive in right away, which I think is a problem as well, but the thing that I really objected to, at the end, he comes out in a fat suit that I'm telling you would embarrass a just starting out amateur theater group, because, I mean, it wasn't at all convincing. So I think the costume let him down when he's supposed to be enormous. It didn't look like real bulk. I was tremendously disappointed in the costume, that the padding was so obvious and fake. So, but yes, again, no problem with Brooks Osmanskas at all. A very fine performance. Yeah, I don't blame the cast for anything. This the leading man, Zach Braff, is terrific. It's a little one note as written, but boy, he throws himself into it, and he's really, really very, very fine as well. I guess I don't like the actress playing Olive, but that has to do again with the writing, and they made it one note and one dimensional. So I found her hard to take. But again, you know, if it ain't on the page, etc.
Michael. I just wanted to throw in there a few points. I was thinking about the songs as well when I was watching it, and you know what kept on coming to mind. And Peter, I thought maybe you'd appreciate this. I have two words that could have fixed the music in this show, and they are Pasek and Paul.
Yes, that's a very good solution, no matter what the show is, because they can adapt to any sound. Christmas Story does not sound like Dogfight at all, which does not sound like James and the Giant Peach either. I mean, they're really good at that.
And I thought that them being so young and working with Woody Allen, it might have been a solution there. I'm sad that, you know, hope, you know, maybe one day they will get a chance to take a run at this show in possibly a massive rewrite, which probably has never happened in the history of Broadway, but we can hope.
But, and you know who else? Who else can write in that sensibility, as I've seen recently, is Jason Robert Brown.
I was thinking that, but he's so busy. And
busy.
you know, that Honeymoon in Vegas feel would have been good thing.
That brings up a good point. If the rumors are true that he did not bring in Honeymoon in Vegas because he didn't want to compete with himself in Bridges in Madison County, you know, that may have turned out to be a mistake, because considering that the Tony race this year is so wide open for Best Musical. Well, you know, by the way, you're mentioning Pasek and Paul writing with Woody Allen. I will admit that Joseph Robinette, and he'd be the first one to tell you, the book writer of Christmas Story, does not have Woody Allen's reputation or resume, but nevertheless, they have proved they can work with an older man. Joseph Robinette probably is around Woody Allen's age. So that would have been something. But again, if he's, and again, I'm supposing here, I'm guessing, if he couldn't, if Marvin Hamlisch found Woody Allen hard to take, imagine what Pasek and Paul would have to deal with. I mean, because Marvin Hamlisch certainly has won awards as well, you know, but Pasek and Paul have not had that type of experience yet in their careers. I predict they will, but at this point, not yet. And Woody Allen, I guess, would have eaten them for breakfast, you know. So what can you do there?
In talking about the Tony race and Mr. Riedel proclaiming that the race is wide open now, that Bullets Over Broadway is not such a shoo-in. I got a chance to see If Then this week. I hadn't seen it last week when you guys had talked about it, and I think that If Then, it, you know, could easily slot into one of the five nominations.
Oh yeah, certainly.
I really had a great time at If Then, which was very different than the both of you had reported on. Week.
I think this year is going to be one of the years where there's going to be less outrage of so and so was robbed. Who knows? I mean, if somebody's true favorite isn't in there, they're going to say so and so was robbed. But nevertheless, less this year than most years. So this really isn't anything can happen here. April 29th is going to be a very interesting day.
And then so that kind of wraps it up with Bullets Over Broadway. Do you guys have any quick things before we go on to the next?
Just really quickly, I wonder if they considered making this play within a play a musical. Just a thought. And, you know, we don't need to discuss it.
You know, I have to admit, you know, that I had an idea that that it was just as phony and terrible as the ones they had. And that is that we see the end of the play and people get curtain calls. And I thought, oh, won't it be funny if Olive takes her curtain calls and suddenly the applause stops? You know, the end of the year. And yet, here I am talking about reality and the best comedy is true comedy, and that wouldn't happen, you know? So I'm as guilty as they are.
All right. So Michael got a chance to see it, The Mystery of Irma Vep at the Lortel. So Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, let me just quickly tell you so that we can go and enjoy our Easter day, that this is a a very solid, wonderful production of The Mystery of Irma Vep, A Penny Dreadful by Charles Ludlam, which I was very, very lucky enough to see in its original production, with Charles Ludlam and Everett Quinton in the roles. The one, two, three, four, five, six, the seven roles. They play seven roles, which is a great deal of the fun. Lightning fast costume changes, scenes in which it appears that one actor is playing two people simultaneously, mm-hmm. Beyond the French doors upstage. It's so clever and so funny, and the writing to me has a much more of a formal aspect. It's more formally elegant and much less scattershot than Ludlam's other plays, which are really much more kind of outrageous and you know, spoofing several genres at one time. This is pretty much I would say the main basis for the spoof is the film Rebecca, but you know, Rebecca combined with the Wolfman and there's even a scene in Egypt, so maybe you get a little bit of, I don't know, Ten Commandments in there or whatever. Mm. It's really well done, and the production design on the Lortel stage, it's really, you know, considering their budget, it's very impressive. John Arnone, scenic designer, Ramona Ponce, costumes, Peter West, lighting, Brandon Walcott, sound, and the wig designer, I must mention, Aaron Kinchin, because the wigs, it would probably be, this is one of those shows where it would probably be as entertaining to watch what's going on backstage as what's going on stage, because these two guys, Arnie Burton and Robert Sella, so talented, so talented. Maybe we don't get to see them as often as we should. They don't work maybe as often as they should, that because they're both really just top drawer. And I'm not saying that they don't work. I mean, they work regularly, but Robert Sella, actually, I haven't seen in quite some time. Arnie Burton was just recently in Peter and the Starcatcher, and then also a few other plays off Broadway that I saw. Whether or not you were like me, lucky enough to catch this play back in the 80s, late 80s, I guess it was, when Charles Ludlam and Everett Quinton did it originally, you now have the incredible opportunity to see Everett Quinton directing these two super talents, Arnie Burton and Robert Sella, in this fabulous production at the Lucille Lortel Theater.
All right. And that's Red Bull Theater is, yes, producing that. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes. So anything else you want to add before we wrap up for the day?
I do, only because it's kind of strange. Masterworks Broadway is releasing an album that Shirley Jones and Jack Cassidy made in 1959 called Marriage Type Love.
Got it in the mail yesterday.
The title comes from Me and Juliet. And last year they put out two albums on one disc of Jones and Cassidy, as they say in the newspaper, in happier times. Anyway, Kevin Parcher, a reader, wrote to me and said, gee, do you think they'll ever release Marriage Type Love? And I said, gee, I don't know about this at all. So they finally did. Here's my point. So I told him about it, and he was very excited. And he bought the CD, and he downloaded it, too. And he said, let me show you some playbills that Jones and Cassidy did over the years. And they were doing Wait Until Dark in a tour. But they also did, and this takes us full circle, not the Three Penny Opera, but the Beggar's Opera. Now, who would have expected these two in the Beggar's Opera? Mm. But again, I can sort of see Jack Cassidy as a McKeith character, and I can certainly see Shirley Jones as a Polly character. So I thought that was surprising that they would wind up doing that. There was also a production of Wish You Were Here they were in that was in Dallas, and in the cast was Roger Puckett, now better known as the person who started Triton Gallery, where we buy all our window cards.
Wow.
Wow. So that was interesting to see as well. But anyway, the album is quite nice with a lot of standards in it. No question about that. But I don't think anything the album could be as arresting as thinking of Shirley Jones and Jack Cassidy doing the Beggar's Opera. I mean, who expects that that's going to be revived with these two stars? It seems like such a stretch, and it tells us about a time when so many more interesting things were being done here and there around the country.
Well, when I was at Threepenny Opera, someone, I think during intermission, said, you know, they should bring back the Beggar's Opera. I think in a really good production, it you know, it might sell. It would be, you know, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily put it on Broadway in a commercial run, but, you know, one of the institutional theaters, just out of curiosity, from what little I know of it, it's really, it's very intriguing.
Well, in the 70s, there was a production, I think at the Chelsea Theater did it. I could be wrong about that.
Okay.
There was a production of the 70s off Broadway that I did not see. But my buddy Richard Norton, who's been paying attention to Broadway since he saw The Triad of Jenny with Mary Martin at the Colonial in 1963, tells me it's one of the 10 best things he's ever seen in his life.
Wow.
So, and believe me, this guy goes to the theater several times a week. So, I'm up for a Beggar's Opera. I've never seen it.
Well, note to the Roundabout and MTC and Lincoln Center. Maybe somebody should look at that.
Yeah, it's a good idea. It's a good idea indeed.
So I'll have a link to that in the show notes, and we'll take a look at that. But that's, excuse me, very interesting, the marriage type love thing. So I'll put the link to Masterworks Broadway there, as well as links to some of the other things that we've talked about today. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. If you subscribe, that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us in iTunes, you can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is a Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And it'll be automatically streamed to you. We also are played on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. And so on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying Happy Easter, and thank you for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye until tomorrow. Goodbye until the next time you call, and I will be waiting. I will be waiting. Goodbye until tomorrow.